Well, investigations are underway in Indonesia after police in Jakarta killed three suspected terrorists who were allegedly planning an attack during the Christmas and New Year period. Authorities say the terror cell was connected to another group arrested 10 days earlier in the Indonesian capital, who were thought to be planning an attack at Indonesia's state palace. In the meantime, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has issued a new travel alert for Indonesia, saying that attacks could take place at any time. Well, Greg Feely is an associate professor and senior fellow in Indonesian politics at the Australian National University's Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs. Greg Feely, very good morning. Welcome to RN Breakfast.
Good morning, Hamish.
This is the latest raid in a number of counter-terrorism operations in Jakarta. The Australian government's advice to travellers says that the terrorist threat level in Indonesia remains high. How real, how significant is the threat as you understand it to be?
I can understand why the Australian government has re-emphasised the terrorism threat in Indonesia, but in reality, Indonesia is no different from a great many countries in the world, including places like France and Great Britain, where there is a constant threat of terrorist attacks. Throughout 2016, the Indonesian police have been arresting suspected terrorists, thwarting terrorist plots. The number of arrests now exceeds 120. Well, actually, with the events of yesterday, that will take the figure to closer to 160, and that's the largest number of terrorist arrests that Indonesia has had since the Bali bombing in 2002. So there's certainly a lot of people who are trying to undertake terrorist attacks. Thankfully, the Indonesian police is having a very good track record of intercepting them.
We understand the militants killed yesterday are thought to be linked to arrests made in the east of Jakarta earlier this month over a separate plot to attack the presidential palace. What do we know about these groups, their affiliations? Where do they sit in the sort of terrorism landscape?
Well, one interesting thing to mention about that planned attack on the presidential palace on the 11th of December was that it involved what seems to be Indonesia's first would-be female suicide bomber, a lady called Dian, who'd married her husband, who is a long-standing jihadist, via telegram messenger, so in other words, over the internet, and had only met him three times, and she had taken a bomb device, a rice cooker filled with nails and explosives and the like, and it was her intention to try to slip past the presidential guard on a last Sunday morning and explode this bomb somewhere strategic within the presidential palace. So it's a very daring attempt. Thankfully, the police had been following her. But this is a first because previously, jihadist leaders, of course, usually very conservative people, have said that it is improper for women to be involved in jihadist operations. More generally, your question about how do these groups link into ISIS, they are all very closely linked. And in particular, they are loyal to one senior Indonesian within ISIS in Syria. And his name is Bahram Naim. And he was the person, he actually spoke to the female suicide bomber over again using telegram messenger and discussed the details of the plot with her. He provided some money for those plotters, and the police are saying that we have the same connection with the group of bombers who were killed yesterday by the police, that they are also linked to Bahram Naim.
And what's the significance of the presence of Indonesians fighting for ISIS? What are the numbers like? How are they being drawn in?
So the latest figures from the Indonesian police are that I think about 546 people, Indonesians, have gone to Syria and Iraq to fight with ISIS. Well over 100 of those have been killed now. A lot of them are being taken out by airstrikes. It's much harder for Indonesians to leave Syria, to leave through Indonesia's control points, through airports and ports and the like. But also it's even harder for them when they get to the Middle East to make their way into conflict zones in Syria. A lot of people are intercepted by Turkish authorities, for example. The One of the interesting things, though, Hamish, is as it's become more difficult for people, jihadists, to get to Syria, this has led to growing frustration within Indonesia, and it's made it easier for ISIS to encourage their supporters in Indonesia to undertake attacks within their home country. And so that's one of the things that's raising the risk. One other thing I would add is it seems a very serious terrorism threat at the moment, and indeed it's not something to be taken lightly. But if we compare the technical capacity of these recent terrorism plots, they are far below what we saw in the early 2000s when Jemaah Islamiyah was conducting operations such as the two Bali bombings in 2002 and 2005, and indeed was exploding large car bombs in front of the Australian embassy. So these people have the intention, but they don't have the skill to carry out really big attacks at the moment. If some of those battle-hardened, well-trained people in Syria return, well, then they could well have the capacity to put together a much more lethal attack. So we haven't seen that happen as yet, but it could well happen in the near future.
And Greg, can we draw a line from Jemaah Islamiyah in the early 2000s to the presence of these sort of ISIS-inspired or in some way connected Islamists in Indonesia today?
Yes, we can. It's a very fragmented picture. And one of the things that ISIS has done is have a polarising effect on Indonesian jihadism. But there are, if we were to draw a big diagram, there are a number of solid lines that we can draw between JI in the from 15 years ago to ISIS groups today. One name that would be familiar to many of your listeners would be Abu Bakr Bashir, who was the emir, the head of JI.
The so-called spiritual leader.
Exactly. At the time of the 2002 bombing, he was more than that. He was really the emir of JI, is a person who has full control over that organisation. And we know that he gave his endorsement to the Bali bombing. Without knowing the details, he nonetheless gave the green light to the perpetrators. So he, as of mid-2014, he has been a supporter of ISIS.
Right.
One would also have to say that JI continues to function. In fact, it seems to have been consolidating in the past year or so, but it is, JI as an organisation, is trenchantly opposed to ISIS. They are one of the main ideological enemies of ISIS within Indonesia.
Okay. We're seeing a lot of the leadership of FPI, Front Pembela Islam, on the news at the moment in relation to Jakarta's Christian governor. Just very briefly, if you can. I mean, I covered these guys over a decade ago for Al Jazeera. They were very much a fringe group that did some sort of small-scale raids on nightclubs and things like that in Jakarta. But they seem to be having a much bigger presence and much bigger influence on the sort of national discourse in Indonesia today. Does this signify a significant change in how Indonesians feel about religion?
I think it's certainly true that FPI has become, or FPI, the Islamic Defenders Front, has become a much bigger organisation than what it was a decade ago. But it's still way behind the really large Muslim organisations in Indonesia. So its membership is in the tens of thousands. The membership of big organisations like Nahdlatul Ulama Muhammadiyah is in the tens of millions. Mm-hmm. They are among the largest Muslim organisations in the world. And FPI actually, it mobilises on particular issues, but it really doesn't. It doesn't have schools, it doesn't have hospitals, it doesn't have birthing clinics, it doesn't have all these assets, all the kind of institutionalisation that the big Islamic organisations have.
Yeah.
What it is very good at,
Greg,
is
I'm actually going to have to interrupt you there. I'm sorry, because we've got to get to the news, but appreciate your time as always. Thanks so much for the insight.
It's a pleasure.
Greg Feely from the ANU's Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs.